Josh might want to say a few words about Steve too, but I'll just say that it's been spectacular having you here, and the work that you've done on cancer genomics has been totally revolutionary. We've gone from zero to a very large, very active, and very well-recognized group in a record short amount of time, and it is definitely driving a hugely exciting project here.
Yeah. I'd say a couple. Yeah, it's been fun working with Steve, and when the rubber hit the road, you've been the point person on the cancer projects, the person we could reliably go to, and some of these important analyses you've been doing this past year. It's been a pleasure to work with you and Charlie. You and Charlie are like the dynamic duo and trio, I guess, with Zach, and working on these pathway models that it's been a pleasure to advise you on. So, looking forward to the talk.
Great, thank you. So I'm Steve, and this is my thesis advancement titled Sample-Specific Cancer Pathway Analysis Using PARADIGM. So here's a quick overview of what I'll be covering, a quick introduction, some previous work, my first aim, which is PARADIGM Integrated Pathway Analysis. Aim 2 is modeling pathways using sequencing data, and then aim 3, directing combination therapies. So it's become clear in the last 50 years that modern medicine has made great strides in preventing deaths from in some of the top killers, such as heart disease, stroke, and influenza and pneumonia. This has come out as a result of things like aspirin, and obviously as we learn more about these diseases. But as far as cancer is concerned, we've made little progress, unfortunately. We've managed to make chemotherapies less toxic, and we've managed to improve quality of life, but in the end, it's done very little. So why is cancer such a difficult problem? Well, when you have normal cell division, you have a cell that divides, the stem cells, eventually these cells differentiate, and they have checkpoint control and other things to prevent them from growing out of control. And when you have a cancer cell, so now you have a cancer cell, or a cancer-prone cell, because you've inherited some sort of mutation, such as a mutation to a tumor suppressor, like P10 or P53, and this inherited mutation came from either your mother or your father, but the second copy of the gene is working fine, so your cell can divide fine and still has checkpoint control. But then you go out in the sun one day and forget to wear your sunscreen, and you pick up what we call somatic mutation. Now the somatic mutation has effectively knocked out that tumor suppressor gene. cells continue to divide, but they've lost control now, so they grow. And they grow independent of growth factors. They don't respond to anti-growth factors. They have no way to kill themselves through mechanisms like apoptosis. That's one way. Another way is overactivation of something like an oncogene. So that can be a single mutation to a gene in a particular domain that turns it from being a controlled mechanism to uncontrolled. And so that's something like BRAF, which is just a kinase that when you have a mutation in certain domains, it becomes constitutively active and sends signals throughout the cell, causing it to grow uncontrollably. So one of the major problems is with treatment options. We have a couple of classical treatments in cancer, surgery and chemotherapy. Obviously, chemotherapy is very toxic to the body. We like to prevent it if possible, but it's oftentimes what we fall back on. More recently, we've had these targeted therapies come about, and this really started about 30 years ago with tamoxifen, which is a hormone therapy that works in hormone-positive breast cancer. This really didn't take off, though, until the late 90s when we came up with Herceptin out of Genentech, and this is a monoclonal antibody which targets ERBB2, which is an EGFR family receptor, and it sits on the surface of the cell, and when it's overexpressed and overamplified in breast cancer cells, then it sends extra growth signals to the cancer. When you have a monoclonal antibody that targets that, you end up basically starving the cancer from those growth signals, and it eventually kills itself. It's basically been addicted to this signal that it no longer has. There's about 30 of these targeted therapies actually now available in the last 10 years. And we like to use these targeted therapies, obviously, when possible, but it's not always possible because we don't know the mechanisms behind each individual's cancer. And each of these cancers within an individual, because they arise from these random mutations, have very unique properties often. So we need to aim towards being able to provide better targeted therapy, helping clinicians make these targeted therapy decisions when a new patient comes into the clinic. Another problem is with data processing. Until about 20 years ago, we basically were doing single gene assays, getting a few data points here and there. 20 years ago, we came up with microarrays, and now we can get about 1 million data points in a single assay. It takes a week or two to run a microarray. And obviously now we're in the sequencing revolution. So now we're getting greater than 200 billion data points from sequencing runs. The problem is no longer generating the data. That is not a big issue. The problem is analyzing all this data and condensing it down so something that like a clinician or a basic biologist can understand it. How do we do that? A clinician is not going to look at an entire genome read of a run on the sequencer and say, oh, obviously this gene is the most important. We need to condense that information down into something they can use. And so how do we make this information clinically actionable? Well, I like to really think about this problem by approaching it with pathways. Okay, so here are three pathways. These were pathways identified by the Cancer Genome Atlas in a 2008 publication in Nature. And these were found to be the most important pathways in glioblastoma. That's a brain cancer. And when you look at the individual elements within each of these pathways, basically, most elements maybe have about 50% alteration rate. So there's a couple of genes up here with mutations or deletions about 50%. It might pass some statistical cutoffs, but in general, not. You really can't say this is these individual alterations are affecting the entire cohort of samples. But when you start to aggregate this information over the pathways, you see numbers that are in basically 80 to 90% of alterations. And the interesting thing that comes out of this is that once you have some sort of alteration in one of these pathways, there's actually some mutual exclusivity. It's very unlikely you get a second alteration in that pathway. And so this really adds a lot of weight to the idea that we need to think about these groups of genes and the way they interact together in order to fully understand how this cancer is developed across a set of patients. So there's a few different ways we can analyze pathways. One of them is to basically overlay data onto a curated pathway structure. So that's kind of what I've just shown you there, which is basically you just find a couple of data sources and add up all the alterations, throw the percentages onto some curated pathway structure that a biologist has predetermined, and pick out what you want for your publication. The next way is to treat pathways as gene sets or bags of genes. And so this basically throws out all the interaction details within a pathway. And this is an approach used by something like GSEA out of the Broad. You look for over-enrichment, over-alteration within a pathway based on some statistical measure. If you care about the interactions, the most popular way to look at these pathways is using Bayesian networks or Bayes nets. And these give you some probabilistic sense of the underlying structure of the graph and how likely certain things are to be altered. And this is a pretty good approach, but you run into problems with things like cycles, which are very difficult to represent in Bayes nets, and are very, very common in biological systems. Like feedback loops are one of the most common things we see in pathways. So you can slightly modify that idea of Bayes nets and treat these things as factor graphs. And factor graphs are basically bipartite graphs. They can be thought of as a generalization of a Bayes or a Markov net. This is a textbook example of a Bayes net, actually. And so what this is Bayes net is saying is that you're looking at the probabilities associated with, given that the grass is wet or not, what is the probability that it either rained or that the sprinklers went off? And there's some probability associated with it being cloudy that day. So you can assign probabilities to all these events and then use Bayes' rule and come up with some posterior probabilities. Well, you can represent that exact same thing using a factor graph. And this is the factor graph representation. It's undirected. We've removed all the links and put some factors in there. And factors are basically functions that help you marginalize these probabilities. And so you can basically obtain the exact same probabilities, same posterior probabilities from the factor graph, or from the factor graph that you can from the Bayes net. And now you can represent things like cycles really easily, and it's very computationally tractable. There's nice message passing algorithms to iterate over these things. And factor graphs have been used successfully in pathway work, including Charles Vaske and his thesis work, where he would learn pathways using a similar approach. And a lot of this work is built on that. So I'm going to go a bit into some of the previous work that I've done here. Obviously, the big project I've been involved in is the UCSC Cancer Genomics Browser. And this is a browser that's built on top of the Genome Browser and specializes in viewing high-throughput data from cancer genomics. And so what you're looking at here are three different cancers. We have a pancreatic cancer up top, glioblastoma, which is the brain cancer, and then melanoma. And this is chromosome 9 along the x-axis. And so at every position here, we've sorted the data And so you're looking at the proportion of patients that have either a copy number deletion or an amplification. So the deletions are represented by blue here, and amplifications are red. And as you go along, you can pretty easily identify a common peak across these three cancers. And that peak is CDKN2A. It's a very well-known tumor suppressor, and it's very commonly deleted and, across all of these cancers. And it's been shown independently in all three that this happens, but you know, this visualization gives you a nice way to condense down the information across multiple cancer types and look at it all together to see commonalities between cancers. We can also sort of toss out the genomic coordinates and look at things like gene sets or pathways. And so this is a visualization of the three pathways that I showed you from the introductory slide, which is P53, RB, and RTK. And this is glioblastoma data again. So over on the right here, you can actually see some clinical attributes about each sample, including if it's a normal or a tumor sample. And at the top here, we have somatic mutations. Then we have germline mutations. And these are frequencies being measured here. And then we have some copy number data. Again, red is amplifications, blue is deletions. And you can see now this last track we've done a statistical test, a t-test between the tumor and the normal. So you're actually looking at regions that are statistically significant between the tumor and the matched blood normal of those patients. You can see a bunch of peaks. Every time, everywhere a peak is colored is statistically significant. And everywhere a peak up here beats this gray line, then statistically it beats some background distribution. And when we overlay the genes that are actually being being displayed there, we see some really common, well-known cancer genes, P53, RB, EGFR. And so this gives you a nice way to visualize data across different data types in a really condensed view and allows you to group together sort of functional ideas like gene sets to represent this information. So when we, as a part of the cancer browser, we've been involved in a bunch of collaborations and consortiums. And the first one we really worked with was the I-SPY trial. And that's a breast cancer clinical trial out of UCSF headed by Laura Esserman. And next week was TCGA, the Cancer Genome Atlas, is NCI's flagship cancer project. And they're hoping to analyze 20 different tumor types with about 500 samples in each. And then more recently with Stand Up to Cancer, we've been involved in a Stand Up to Cancer dream team for breast cancer headed by Joe Gray at Lawrence Berkeley, as well as Dennis Slayman at UCLA. And then through the genome browser, we have all the ENCODE data, as well as a few spin-off cancer browsers focused on different types of data. This is all open source, and there's a nice public portal for it all. So as part of being involved with these consortiums and collaborations, it's become evidently clear that the new way to generate this data is to try and generate as much data about a single sample as we can. So the I-SPY, this really started with the I-SPY trial, where they started generating copy number, gene expression, and proteomics data for 150 different breast cancer patients. And then more recently with TCGA, where for 500 samples across 20 different cancers, we have copy number data, gene expression, methylation, mutation, microRNA, and these are all array-based right now, but are rapidly moving to sequencing-based technologies. So this is a lot of data about a single sample. And it really got me thinking, how can we best use this data to figure out exactly what's going on in each sample? Right now, people have basically gone through the process of, you know, finding the top alterations in copy number, finding the most overexpressed genes and gene expression independently, and then trying to figure out some way to intelligently combine those lists into something that represents an idea of what's happening across the cohort. But, you know, there's got to be a better way that we know all this information comes from the same sample. There's got to be a better way that we can combine it all. So our first attempt at combining this is what we call the biointegrator, and this is work that I did with Zach Sanborn, and it's a pipeline for automated cancer sample analysis. And the base behind biointegrator is it's a database backend for storage efficiency and normalization of cancer samples. There are nice ways to select out individual samples worth of data, as well as a set of samples for a certain clinical feature. You can get both primary data and then build modules on top of it, which get run on a regular basis. We also have a nice web front end for visualizing all the underlying data. It's all drag and drop, nice web 2.0. You can do correlation analysis, graphing. It does some subgrouping, allows you to group by different clinical features and visualize the differences between features there. So this is a nice way just to be able to visualize the underlying data in the database. So our first real module that we wrote for the BioIntegrator was what we call a meta-analysis module. So the idea behind meta-analysis is you're taking independent data sources and trying to combine them in a statistically reasonable way. And so we have copy number data and gene expression for this melanoma cohort. And we basically use a meta-analysis to combine those values into what we call a meta-gene. So now we have a meta-gene which represents some average or p-value average of these two original data sources. And using those metagenes, we can plug them into some sort of supervised learning method like SVM Lite and try to predict something like BRAF mutation status. Now, BRAF mutation status in melanoma is interesting because there are actually treatments that are being derived to treat BRAF mutant melanoma patients. And it's not, you know, obviously you can determine BRAF mutation status by sequencing. So it's not so much interesting that we can predict that feature as it is we use the machine learning to tell us what other factors are associated, what other features are help the machine learner predict that. You know, we don't give the machine learner the actual sequence or the mutations. We tell it this is a mutant or this is a non-mutant, find me, tell me all the features that help you decide that. So when we look at the top features, here's just a quick graph of those features. And so we ran a bunch of iterations of cross-validation and only kept models that basically did 90% accuracy or higher. These were ranked by their SVM weight. And then you can also see the frequency in gray of how many times they appeared in a model. And when we take that list of genes and plug it into NCI, NCI has a nice pathway enrichment feature. And we can take that list, plug it into NCI, get an enrichment p-value for certain pathways. And so this one pathway really popped to the top with a nice enrichment p-value. And it's a subset of caspase cascade. Caspase cascade is a pathway that's involved in determining a cell's decision to perform apoptosis or not. And so, you know, it's interesting that this BRAF mutation status somehow has something to do with determining whether or not the cell can actually undergo apoptosis. So this was a nice result that allowed us to, you know, we were obviously starting to think about how we can combine data, but it was a little naive in that it was just multiplying the original data types together, and we needed a better underlying model to represent that data. And so that really gets me to my first aim, which is Paradigm. It's an integrated pathway analysis. And this is work that I've done in collaboration with Charlie and Josh. And Paradigm, the idea behind it is, well, it stands first for pathway recognition algorithm using data integration on genomic models. And we take in a bunch of curated pathways from NCI. So we have a bunch of interactions subset into functional pathways. And for each gene in that pathway, we have a factor graph representation, which is modeled after the central dogma. So we have a gene copy number node, which is like the DNA node. We have an expression state node, which is the equivalent of the RNA node. We have a protein level, and then we have a protein activity for an activated protein. And then what we can do is we can take the primary data that has been collected on these samples and attach them as observations. So here we can attach some, like array copy number data, or SNP chips, or DNA sequencing. Here we can attach microarrays from expression analysis. And we also have hooks in here for the interactions. So if we know a specific interaction is a transcriptional regulation, it would hook in between the copy number and expression state. And if we know something's a kinase signaling, it would hook in between the protein and protein activity state. So this is a really nice intuitive model that allows us to sort of understand and makes biological sense. So I've gone over a couple of the types of interactions we represent. We also have the idea of gene families, which are functionally equivalent genes that can perform this, basically the same function. And if you think of that like a Boolean representation, it's almost like an OR connection. So the idea being that you really only need one of those to perform the downstream function of those parents. We also have formation of a complex, a protein complex, and that's basically a Boolean AND because you need all three of those proteins in order to actually be able to form that complex. So, if we break out a small example, we can actually see what this factor graph ends up looking like. So we have this pathway up here, NDM2 inhibits P53, which activates apoptosis. It's a very classic relationship. This is the central dogma representation of NDM2 and P53 and apoptosis here. And the underlying data that gets attached to this model is actually a discrete model. So we say that something is either down, that hasn't changed, or it's up based on some cutoffs. So here we've attached an example of this mRNA, we see an observation that implies that MDM2, we think, has increased amounts of mRNA sitting around. So that's increased gene expression. And when we propagate this through the network, we see, we infer that there's increased protein, increased activity. So this is an inhibition link. We switch the sign on this and we say decreased amount of protein of P53, decreased activity of P53, and decreased apoptosis. And so the nodes we're really interested in here are these activity nodes, because these provide us some insight as to, you know, how this data has been combined with the interactions. And so we have a score for those activity nodes, and we call that score the integrated pathway activity, or the IPA. And here's the math behind that score. Basically the log odds of the data for the most probable state given the model, and we subtract out the odds of the state given no data attached. So we detach all the data and run the factor graph again, and subtract out that signal, because we want to remove any intrinsic sort of structure of the pathway that maybe provides some probabilities from our priors. And then we give it a sign based on the most probable state. So if it's a positive state, we keep the sign positive. If we think it's downregulated, we give it a negative sign, and zero otherwise. So we can take all this, run it across all of our pathways, and get basically an IPA for every single entity within the pathway. But we need to figure out what pathway is the top pathway within a cohort. And so we do that by permuting the data and creating fake samples by selecting samples, data from the original data sets with replacement. And so we create about 1,000 samples like that, and we run them through Paradigm again. And we create what we call a Shazam plot. And so the Shazam plot basically represents the difference between the real data and the permuted data. So across the x-axis, you can see the black line here is the mean of the permuted data. This gray band that you can kind of see on the right here is 3 standard deviations away from that mean. The red line indicates the real data, and this is actually what we've sorted by, the mean of the real data. And then the pink band around that is 3 standard deviations away from that. Anywhere you see a word or a dot indicates the number of samples that have beaten the 3 standard deviations away from the null model. So if it's a dot, then it's less than 10 samples. And if you see a name, then it's more than 10 samples, and we throw the number of samples after the name. So here you can see this is a breast cancer data set, and this is the HIF-1 alpha transcription factor network. And you can see AKT1 is highly upregulated in this cohort, and it's the most upregulated thing compared to the null model. And there's 85 samples out of 113 that actually beat that null model. So this just gives us a way to rank pathways, but we need to compare to existing methods. And so the best existing method we could find was called SPIA, and it's Signaling Pathway Impact Analysis, and it's by Giordici. It was published about 2 years ago. And the idea behind SPIA is that we score pathways using expression data. They weight genes by their degree of connectivity. It's sort of thought of as like the opposite of Google PageRank. So Google PageRank, the idea behind that is the highest ranked pages are the ones that have the most links pointing to them for a given term. If you reverse that logic and say, okay, now the highest ranked entities within a pathway are the ones with the most links out. So the ones with the most child links have the highest impact in a pathway. And so they weight it by the number of child links you have. And how can we compare these two methods? Well, given a set, you know, we have a huge set of cancer pathways, about 130 cancer pathways. If we rank all our pathways and then we rank them all with SPIA, that doesn't really give us any more information because they're all cancer pathways. How do you say that one list of cancer pathways is necessarily better than another list? Well, what we did was we wanted to create decoy pathways and then test who found the most real pathways versus the decoy pathways. So to create those decoy pathways, basically we took our original set of pathways and replaced every gene in the pathway with a random gene from the genome. And that keeps the degree of connectivity within the pathway the same, as well as the structure. And it allows us to sort of fairly compare these two methods. And so when we look at the two methods compared, the solid lines here are Paradigm, and the dashed lines are SPIA. And this is using 2 different cohorts, that breast cohort, as well as the glioblastoma TCGA cohort. And in both cases, Paradigm does better at finding real pathways. And so what you're looking at is, well, it's similar kind of to a rock plot. I mean, you have fraction of total pathways on the x-axis here, fraction of real pathways on the y-axis. So perfect method would go all the way, well, basically be a straight line up and then over. And so we can look at the area under both of those curves and actually get some numerical estimation of how well we're doing compared to SPIA. And in both cases, you know, we're doing better. So this is great. This shows that our method is actually better than the best existing method out there. And so now we can start to look at the data and sort of see what it tells us. And when we look at that glioblastoma data set and do an unsupervised clustering, here's an unsupervised hierarchical clustering, and we can subgroup this data. We can basically cluster this data into a few different clusters just visually and identify some functional groups for this. And you can identify also the pathways that drive each of these groups. So we have this large EGFR-driven, these two clusters that are largely EGFR-driven in glioblastoma. There's a well-known glioblastoma signature, and there's actually treatments being designed just for that signature. And there's also this large GATA interleukin down-regulated signal. But really interesting to us was this low HIF-1-alpha in cluster 4. And so we can take these clusters, because we have survival data, and look at them on a Kaplan-Meier plot. And a Kaplan-Meier plot, basically, if you've never seen this before, it's survival along the x-axis and proportion surviving along the y-axis. So you can do this for each cluster and look at the proportion that are surviving over time and compare different clusters. And there's some statistics that let you do this, so the log rank is one. And when we do this, we see a significant p-value that the red cluster is significantly different than the other three clusters in a survival setting. So we've successfully stratified these patients into four different clusters, and one cluster has almost twice as much survival when you at any given time point across this Kaplan-Meier. We can take some TCGA ovarian cancer ovarian data and do a similar thing. And so these are IPAs for ovarian cancer. Now I've used, instead of hierarchical clustering in this case, I've used a more conservative clustering method called HOPOC, which uses the MSS statistic to determine the optimal number of clusters. And in this case, it found 5 clusters optimally, mostly because the clusters as visually were not as easy to identify. So I wanted some statistical measure of how the best number of clusters. So we see this PIK3CA cluster, is this red cluster. We see some high HIF-1-alpha in this cohort. We see a few, PIK3R1 related pathways down here. But I'm most interested in this HDAC3 large blue sloth here, which is a few different pathways, but basically dealing with histone-deacetylase related things. And when we consider that pathway across all the other samples here, we've just done a pairwise comparison in this case. Again, it's statistically significant. Even if you correct for all possible pairwise combinations, it's still a statistically significant p-value. So again, we've successfully stratified this patient into one subgroup that does significantly better in a survival group. So this is really exciting, because now not only have we proven that we're doing better than the best method, but we have ways to subgroup these patients into and identify ones that will do better in the long run or worse. And so there's obviously a bunch of work to still be done on this part of things. Most importantly, to incorporate mutations, methylation, and microRNA into the model. There's hooks in there for them, but things like mutations are not as obvious maybe as they seem. There are two real main types of mutations in cancer. You can either knock out a tumor suppressor, or you can activate an oncogene, and making the decision of what is what is not trivial. So we're going to need to go to some collaborators to help us make that decision. We need more pathway sources in there. Like I said, we really only use cancer pathways right now. We really need metabolic pathways in there to help us. These are things that are becoming really important, have been identified as really important in cancer recently. The last thing I want to do is on this aim is basically try a unified pathway of the cell. So right now we have a bunch of sort of different pathways that represent some sort of functional thing that the cell needs to perform. And in each of those pathways is an entity, and those entities can appear in multiple pathways. So it can be kind of confusing when you go talk to a collaborator and they see the same entity appear multiple times across multiple pathways. Well, I mean, it makes sense in some context, because you're looking at just some specific context that the cell is trying to work under, but it's not realistic in that it's not really what's going on in the cell. So if we can combine all those pathways and basically smash all the links together across all the data sources, and hopefully come up with something that might be computationally tractable, then we might be able to run a more interesting pathway model that represents reality a bit more. And we can look at regions of that large pathway that might be over or under activated. So getting to the next aim, modeling pathways using sequencing data. It's become very clear that mainstream sequencing has arrived. Okay, there's 100 full cancer genome sequences available today. TCGA is planning to do 50 whole genomes per cancer type with about 20 cancer types, as well as full exome sequencing for the rest. And the nice thing is that the underlying model of Paradigm still works fine. You can still attach data. Instead of attaching the optical intensities from microarrays, now we're attaching read counts to this model, and it can still performance function just fine. But what we're more interested in from this, what we're more interested in from the sequencing data is the extra information that we get as a result. And so if we go back and look at this ovarian heat map again, we can identify one large red region across all the samples, and this is FOXM1. And when we look at the numbers of FOXM1, if you consider all of the NVs and all of the samples for a pathway, and you look at the number that beat the null model, for FOXM1 is close to 50%. The next highest pathway in ovarian is at 14%, and then you're down around 12 or 10% for the next top ones. So this is a staggering difference in the percentage of alterations from our null model. And so, you know, this really got us interested in what FOXM1 is in ovarian and what its role is. And we can look at the Shazam plot for FOXM1 and identify that all the entities are basically up. Obviously, the rightmost entity down here is FOXM1. And we easily beat the null model through most of this pathway. And the mean, you know, the mean and standard deviation deviate really far away. And the entities that are in this pathway are both cell cycle and DNA repair related. And so that's really interesting because obviously there's, you know, cell has to make a decision about, you know, is it going to try to do DNA repair? Is it going to try to basically go through cell cycle again? And this is an important decision, especially when you're considering cancer samples. So what is FOXM1? Well, it's this forkhead box M1 transcriptional factor. There's three main isoforms, and they're basically distinguished by these exons that may or may not appear. FOXM1A is actually, everyone thinks that it's actually an inactive form of the transcription factor because this extra exon actually hides the DNA binding domain. The C isoform is a DNA damage repair isoform, and the B isoform is the one with targets in cell cycle. And so these both have different targets, and some of that is based on this, I think, CHEK2 phosphorylation site, which may or may not be hidden based on this exon appearing or not. Here's the constitutive DNA binding sequence, as well as a nice little picture of it binding to DNA. So when we look at this in more detail, we see that really this is, like I said, a transcription factor at the crossroads of DNA repair and cell cycle. And so this is visualization is what we call a circle map. And each spoke in this circle is this individual patient sample. The inner ring here is actually gene expression data, and the outer ring is copy number data. So you can see that the primary data for this is the reason Paradigm thought this was a top pathway is mostly expression driven. Only about 5% of FOXM1 patients actually have genomic amplifications, significant genomic amplifications. And you can see over here on the left are some cell cycle targets, and over here on the right I've just highlighted one of its DNA damage repair targets, but it has a couple. And interestingly enough, it's been shown in the last year that P53 is an active repressor of FOXM1. And this is really interesting in ovarian cancer because we know from the literature that about 90 to 100% of ovarian samples have mutated, inactivated P53. So it makes a lot of sense why we're seeing overactive FOXM1. Well, because it's one of its active repressors, its main active repressor, is actually not able to function in its role. And
So why is not the P53 included in the pathway? Why do you distinguish FOXM1 as it's kind of its own pathway?
We pull in the pathways from curated data sources, so like NCI's pathway interaction database. They haven't yet added that interaction into the database. This is an interaction that was found, that's been basically implicated in literature about 6 months ago. So maybe it just hasn't gotten in there yet. But yeah, it's unclear at this point why they haven't added it in there. But that's a good question. Thank you. So
The fact that these are dotted lines, what's the difference between a dotted line?
A transcriptional versus some other function. it's interesting because we have two different isoforms and they perform two different functions. So we want to be able to establish which isoform is overrepresented. You know, it's clear from the expression that they're both targets are actually being activated here. But we want to know proportions and maybe see if there's some sort of mutations or alterations in the two isoforms of FOXM1 to actually figure out exactly what's going on here. We have no hope of doing that from DNA microarrays. Sequencing is pretty much critical in this stage, and so we need to be able to detect isoform-specific transcripts. The way we can do that is using RNA-seq, and we'll be trying to use a pipeline that's being developed by Daniel Zerbino here, using Velvet, Columbus, and Oasis, And something like SOLAS, which is basically an isoform detecting algorithm that helps you determine relative amounts, basically turns RNA-seq into the equivalent of what you'd use for DNA microarrays. On top of that, we really need to move to allele-specific signals because we get all that information out of DNA sequencing. And for instance, Zach's program BAM-BAM will give us allele-specific copy number and alterations. So that's information that we that's really important to us as well. And so what would a model look like that incorporated all this information? Well, here's one possibility. So now we've got the central dogma, and this is just a fake gene that I've come up with, and we have the two different alleles, allele 1 and allele 2. And then, which of course there could be more, but it's unlikely, it's unusual in cancer that that happens. We also have two isoforms in this gene isoform A and isoform B. And we have hooks for all the primary data that we might get as a result. So allele 1's copy number, allele 2's copy number. Allele 1, gene 1A's transcript, allele 2, gene 1A's transcript. And so then we have now, as a result, four outputs that we can actually look at. The IPA is four, both, you know, both allele and isoform specific outputs. And maybe that will help us get to the bottom of exactly what is going on in something that, like the FOXM1 story. On top of that, using RNA-seq data, we get some really interesting data on gene fusions. So gene fusions are very easily detectable by RNA-seq. They're very uncommon in solid tumors. They're reasonably common in blood-based tumors, but really uncommon. But even if they're uncommon, they are critical to model. And the reason they're critical to model is because when they occur in solid tumors, they are probably the driving cause of the cancer. So that is could be the singular answer of why this cancer is growing out of control. And the way we might model that would be to dynamically add a new pathway that represents the fusion of both the parents and children. And so if you can think of the two original pathways, assuming that gene occurs in two different pathways, those two genes occur in two different pathways, we can take all the parents from both pathways, make a new pathway dynamically that includes all the parents and all the children from both of those two genes. And that might allow us to look at, and then we can use some statistical measures like the likelihood of the data given the pathway to identify if that new pathway is actually better or worse than the two original pathways. And on the right here, I've just illustrated basically the most classical example of a gene fusion in cancer. And this is a translocation between chromosome 9 and 22 that form what we know as the Philadelphia chromosome. And this is the BCR8 gene fusion. So as far as future work is concerned, there's obviously a lot left to be done here, but we need to work on regularizing sequencing data for attaching to the model. You know, SOLAS will give us part of the way for RNA data, but we also need that for genomic data. Adding support for that allele and isoform specific central dogma, I've identified what that model might look like, but obviously we need to code it in there and add the ability to dynamically create it, because we don't always want that complicated of a model existing in the pathways. It may become computationally intractable to run something like that. You're changing from basically four nodes to 14 nodes in that one example, and there may be more isoforms. And then also we need to model gene fusions using that method I just outlined. So final aim, which is directing combination therapies. So the goal here is to identify shRNAs that can be used to convert drug-resistant samples into sensitive ones. So we want to identify critical points in the pathway, simulate shRNA combinations in silico, and then use cell lines to test these predictions. Okay, well, first question is, are cell lines going to be good enough? This is some data from Joe Gray's lab. The primary data is from Joe Gray's lab at North Berkeley, and he has about 50 breast cancer cell lines that he's profiled both on copy number and gene expression. And this is a heat map of the IPAs that we produced out of Paradigm by running on those results. And so you can see some of the common pathways that I pointed out before, but more importantly are these clusters that form as a result of clustering this data. And these five clusters that I've identified up here are classical breast cancer subtypes. And so the main point of this slide is basically that we can take cell line data and run it through Paradigm and get out the same classical breast cancer subtypes that we can get out of solid tumors. So this is some sort of basically a positive control to make sure that we're not totally off our rockers and trying to use cell lines for something that they just won't be useful for at all. We see classic basal and luminal signals, including high amounts of FOXM1 in the basals, and as well as some interesting signals that may be specified basal A from basal B.
Steve, I got a little lost here. So sure. These designations, luminal basal, that's basically from when the cell line was made, the pathology of the source material that
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Right, and they have these different ones that they identify in solid tumor as well.
So you cluster, but you clustered those.
Wait, but this is all cell lines.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. Well, I'm just trying to make the point that the cell lines and the solid tumor share the exact same clusters, and we can cluster them together similarly. Like, it would be bad if these clustered all over the place and we didn't get the original clustering subgroups out from the IPAs. Does that make sense?
Except for this clustering, your basal A's are going into four different clusters.
Well, actually, this doesn't have optimal leaf ordering, so you can actually swap this over and it would sit right there, and then you could swap this leaf around and it would sit right there, and you wouldn't get the one. All right, so we can take those cell line IPAs, and as well as a bunch of drug targets, known drug responses and drug targets. So Joe Gray has gone through and classified about 70 different drugs on these cell lines. And all that data was taken pre-treatment. And so now we have also IC50s for all the cell lines for about 70 different drugs. And when I take that data and I just do a simple Pearson's correlation between the drug responses and all of the IPAs across the 50 cell lines, what we can do is we can pick out what paradigm is identified as the most likely target for those drugs. So the idea being that, you know, if you run a correlation, you would expect the IPA's level to correlate with the IC50s or the drug response if that was an actual target of that drug, because the proteins with low IPAs. You would expect not to be affected by a drug, and the ones with high IPAs would be affected by that drug. And so this is the top correlation between the drug erlotinib and EGFR, which is actually erlotinib's target. So I didn't tell this anything about targets, and it managed to find the best p-value. This is the top p-value of all the correlations I did, and it's multiple hypothesis corrected using Bonferroni. And the top correlation in this case is erlotinib with its target through the integrated pathway activities. So this, again, just another positive control that showed that the IPAs are helping us to pinpoint the actual targets without even providing that information. So obviously, when we go and do this, we're going to need something more complicated than just a correlation. We can use some supervised learning to perform to do this analysis. So we can do some sort of feature selection and support vector machine to find all possible contributing entities. It's not good enough just for us to find the top one, especially since we can probably look it up from the drug target database. When we do find all possible contributing entities to a particular drug's sensitivity or resistance in a cell line, those would be represented in this table as E1 through 6 and beyond are all the entities that contribute. And then S are the sensitive cell lines. And then we can run this for the resistant cell lines. And we can see two sort of vectors that identify this sensitivity and resistance. And this is ultimately what the SVM is using to make that decision. Our goal in the shRNA screens is to try and make these resistant vectors look as much like the sensitive vectors as possible. The idea being, if we can switch these resistant vectors to look like sensitive vectors, then hopefully that cell line will now become sensitive to that drug. We can use the medioid of the sensitivity vectors to come up with basically a target, and then we can use these shRNA in silico knockouts to try to figure out what entities are likely to move the vectors over to that medioid vector. And so what would that look like? Well, if we have this MDM2 P53 apoptosis pathway again, and we are looking to shRNA against P53, we basically disconnect MDM2, we disconnect all the parents of P53, and we clamp it down in the pathway. Obviously, this is a really simplistic example, but obviously, most of the time you have 100 or more entities in a pathway, so if you can do this in a brute force fashion and iterate through all possibilities and get the vector out after each iteration. And then we can rank all the shRNA entities based on this method and take the top targets to the wet lab. So there's obviously tons of work still left to be done here, identifying the key pathways associated with this treatment resistance. Ranking all the genes by disconnecting the links and then just eventually testing these targets using shRNA screens in the wet lab. And then probably is work we'll do with a collaborator. So bringing it all together, my goal ultimately is to provide clinically relevant information using these pathways I mean, we really need to be able to assist treatment decisions, hope to find new targets using those shRNA screens. And the focus is really on individual tumors. That was a critical point from the design of the algorithm forward, is oftentimes in these consortiums, they try to look for the most common alterations across the entire set of patients. And you really miss out on a lot of the individual alterations that may ultimately be driving that treatment response or resistance. And so it was critical that we come up with a method that can be run on individual tumors. So when you come up with some sort of pathways that are indicative of response or sensitivity when a new patient comes into the clinic, we can measure those pathways and match them to one of those signatures and hopefully identify what treatments will be best. So just like to acknowledge all of the people that made this possible. Obviously my advancement committee, thank you for reading my advancement. Cancer Genomics Group, which has grown from 3 to about 10 very rapidly, as David mentioned. All of our collaborators, including Charlie, who's now at Princeton, our funding agencies that paid for this work, and Cancer Genome Browser staff, and the cluster admins for keeping our clusters running so I could get this work done. So thank you very much. Yes.
Can you go back to the erlotinib correlation slide? Yeah, so you're saying that this is the best p-value for any drug pathway pair, for all drugs?
Well, with multiple hypothesis testing. So the p-value is like, I did like about 5,000 or 10,000 tests. I don't actually have the raw p-value offhand, but yes.
Okay.
So it was actually much lower as far as the correlation is concerned.
Right. Actually, can you just explain what, like in the perfect world where we know that, you know, this is a target, I'm not understanding.
In the perfect world, so let's think about ERBB2 and Herceptin, maybe for example, which is a really well known and pretty well understood. You'd expect that, you know, in order for ERBB2 or Herceptin to work, you need overamplification of ERBB2 and extra copies because the cell becomes addicted to that signal.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd expect the highest pathway activity for the most sensitive drug responders. And
so basically, what we're looking on here is a cell line. Which a ranking of the how sensitive the cell lines were for the drug.
Yes, that's
compared with what the activity of their pathway was before treatment.
Yes.
Okay.
So the
because I was thinking of it after treatment.
No, right. These are all pre-treatment.
Yeah, okay.
That's the important thing.
I mean, that doesn't look like a very good correlation. I mean,
well, it is pretty good actually. I mean, all the negative ones are down here. There's a couple of outliers up here, but.
I mean, I guess what I'm.
I get, but
yeah,
I
mean, maybe what I'm saying is
I
that
mean, I could just as easily have drawn a horizontal line.
You could have stretched out the y-axis and made it look more impressive.
Good point. I'm just wondering if other, you know, I'm sure there were other EGFR inhibitors in the.
Actually, this was the only one that
really?
They used.
Okay.
It was only about 70 of these public drugs. So.
I was going to ask this in the closed session, but since it came up. Those two that look like the outliers on the left.
Yes.
Those are in your scenario. Those would be, you know, cell lines that are sensitive, that aren't sensitive, but have the pathway activity. So
these are like the 25% of ERBB2 or HER2 positive breast cancer patients that don't respond to.
Right.
So,
but did you look at the profile, the cell line profile? Do they have different? Does their profile look like the sensitive or insensitive place?
Yeah, I didn't dig into the data enough.
Yes.
To answer.
Yes, it is.
So, Steve, are most of your data then cell lines, and were those cell lines derived from primary tumors or metastatic disease? Does that matter? Are the patients?
Most of our data is actually from primary tumor.
Okay.
This last aim was all based on cell line data,
okay.
And those cell lines were a mix of. I think mostly derived from primary tumor, but maybe some are from Mets. Maybe one was. Actually, a couple of them are from Mets, yeah.
And does that matter? Are the facts that are matter, or is it like.
That's a really good question. I haven't looked into it enough to answer that.
And are the patients, since it's a primary tumor, they're probably treatment naive, but are there data sets that you have access to where they've been treated?
Well, our collaborator, Joe Gray, actually does have. After every one of these drugs, sets of expression from every cell line. And so we didn't have, we haven't gotten that data yet, so I don't know what it looks like, but there are some people that have done post-treatment. As well as with iSpy, we have various time points with that data, that both pre-treatment, which is the data that, well, actually I didn't show any iSpy data, but we have some pre-treatment data as well as immediately following treatment and then right before surgery as well. So the idea is maybe we could visualize these pathways as they evolve from becoming resistant, as they sort of develop or identify the treatment and try to fight against them. Maybe that would be an interesting project to try. Yes.
On all these things you keep talking about, the data from the tumor samples, do you also have data from the same patients that are not part of the tumors, so you have background information from them, and are you using that in any way?
Well, all the copy number arrays get run on the matched blood of all the tumor samples as well, so because you have to normalize copy number to some normal, whatever the patient's normal is. So
those are already normalized?
Those are already normalized to that. The expression data in the ovarian and glioblastoma states are normalized to a mixture of adjacent normal tissue. So there were about 5 or 10 samples that had adjacent normal expression that I used to normalize that expression data to. The cell lines I just median normalized, so we're looking at differences within the cell line as opposed to differences versus normal in that case. So it's just a matter of how, you have to be careful, obviously, how you phrase the question that you're asking. Are you looking at differences versus normal or differences within the cohort? And are you identifying pathways that are overactive versus what you normally expect, or overactive just compared to these other samples in the cohort?
In mutation data.
Right, and the mutation data as well has to be normalized.
Has from TCJ, they have blood samples.
Yeah, blood for the germline mutation. Right.
Can I ask one more quick question?
Yeah, sure.
So there's actually a guy on campus whose son has glioblastoma, and it's sort of late stage, and so the last treatment was for, they used Avastin,
mm-hmm.
And which I understand binds to VEGF,
mm-hmm.
his nanobody.
Right.
And so sure enough, when they did the MRI, pre and post treatment, it shrank in size, but it migrated from a part of the brain that didn't have very many blood vessels,
mm-hmm.
to one that was loaded with blood vessels. So it just sort of migrated predictably. Are there people doing the kind of thing you do with vasculature in tumors, looking at gene expression? Because that for a while was considered to be exciting work to do.
Well, so the only stuff that I know about is there's been a lot of recent work in glioblastoma in particular about this hypoxia-induced factor, so the HIF-1 alpha, which I showed a few, and we identified as being the higher survival cluster in the glioblastomas. It's been shown that high HIF-1 alpha is actually a really poor prognosis. If you have this really high hypoxia-induced factor, for some reason, you end up having much shorter survival times overall. It's not, people are still trying to understand the exact mechanisms behind that, but sorry.
So just a follow-up on that, because you show that in the glioblastoma, you had that cluster that had low HIF-1 alpha and it had better survival.
Yes, right, exactly.
And then a couple slides later.
Yeah, the ovarian, I didn't show those results.
And
but
you had the high HIF-1 alpha.
I don't have a nice Kaplan-Meier for it, but that high HIF-1 alpha cluster actually did significantly worse than the other clusters.
Okay, I mean, that is a nice.
Yeah, I know, it's
nice exactly
comparison.
Like
I just
you would expect.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I don't
could you
that.
Go back to that, those Kaplan-Meier?
Yeah, sure.
I had a question about that as well.
Which one?
Did it surprise you that the big cohort there, three, I mean, that you weren't really able to distinguish survival in those other three cohorts? I mean, is that unusual that you would have a big pathway signature but have no bearing on survival?
Yeah, unfortunate, but I can't really say it surprised me with the glioblastoma patients, because these are such late stage, by the time they're found, they're very late stage often, and so they all tend to be very aggressive tumors.
Yeah, 60 days, that's...
Yeah, I mean, even the best survival is not good.
No, right.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's... I can't really say it surprises me, but yeah, I understand what you're saying. It'd be interesting to see if there were other clinical features that match over with those other clusters.
Well, I guess I'm just thinking about how you would take this into the clinic immediately, this kind of analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Assuming the clinician can maybe do a sort of a rough microarray of, say, 200, just looking at expression of 200 genes.
Right.
Could you take that kind of a constraint and use the paradigm to,
that's
to guide the selection of those?
Yeah, that's the hope. I mean, I would feel less confident about it in such an aggressive tumor type, but in something like, ovarian, obviously the Kaplan-Meiers are much better even after, these are actually months, I didn't
wait,
I apologize, but, even after 4 years, you still have a majority of patients surviving. I think you could, and probably what people have done, for instance, in breast cancer, have looked at, it's oftentimes in breast cancer, you don't even need treatment for, you can just surgically resize the tumor and it will never grow back, and that you can walk along, be a happy person, and you don't need chemotherapy or anything. And so people have done studies to try and determine when chemotherapy is needed and when it's not needed. And so with something like this, I think that we would have a good chance of at least improving on, at least as good as the other signatures, probably improving on them. And so we can help with make those decisions probably almost immediately, but obviously the figuring out the drug targets is a bit more difficult.
Yeah.
Just a quick follow-up on Scott's question. So I think what it's getting at is that you're going to develop paradigm with all of these rich set of inputs.
Right.
And if you're successful, you will get good classification, good prognosis,
absolutely,
or good recommendation for therapeutic out of your methodology. But then is there a model in which you might take that to the clinic in the sense that you would adapt it to a situation where you didn't have such a rich set of inputs because it's too expensive to get all that information about each patient? Could you, for example,
in a couple of years, hopefully it won't be that expensive
to
get all
that
information.
That's a possibility.
But
could you adapt it to treat as missing information the ones that you don't have?
Yeah,
still try
right,
to reason
yes,
based on the information that you do
yes,
have about the patient.
Well, and the other thing is I mean, hopefully, you're looking at what did you say, 100 and some odd pathways?
Yeah,
in paradigm. But given, for each of these cancers, you're looking at a broad spectrum of samples, hopefully you get an idea of what are the major pathways that are varying.
Right.
And, at some point, if you've looked at 500 breast cancer samples, and if you have some confidence that they're really representing the broad spectrum, and pathway X never really does much or never really does much in any meaningful way,
mm-hmm,
to me, a huge value of this analysis would be saying, okay, for the most part, pathway X isn't so informative, so we don't really need to worry about it.
Yeah.
I don't think it's not, none of us thinks it's going to be one pathway that you're
right,
going to be able to say, that's the
yeah,
one. But, hopefully you can get it to some, there can be some discriminatory.
These are the 140 NCI pathways. And so all of them are, these are all the usual suspects.
But again, I still believe that in particular cancer types, subsets of them. Will it be a dozen? I don't know.
Wolgenstein's dozen. That's right.
I don't know if it's going to be a dozen, but I would think that in ovarian, it's going to be a different subset than glioblastoma.
Sophie, what are you recommending? That he doesn't even score these, so he runs on a bunch of cancers and he finds that some pathways are more informative than others, and then we can just ignore going forward the ones that aren't.
I would.
Because we'll always be asked, I can anticipate, the biologist will ask us, did you score pathway Y? And we'll say, it wasn't important in the other cancers, and they'll wonder if it still is in this one.
Well, this is what I'm saying. If you look at a broad spectrum of samples, which presumably is the point of these things in breast, right? I'm not saying that I've decided that pathway X isn't important in breast, and now I'm looking at pancreatic cancer, and I'm still not going to look, at that point, I would still look at all of the pathways.
Greg Cannon, who's one of our collaborators at Harvard doing the SHRNA test, his criticism of this is.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, and it's unconscionable that you guys.
What about the other 1,000 metabolic pathways?
Yeah, it's unconscionable that you guys don't have metabolic pathways. I mean, they had them for years, you know, there's.
I have a fan here on Skype, and he said, it is interesting that Steve's analysis identified alotrinib as the most probable significant drug response correlation. Alotrinib is currently probably the most successful target drug for lung cancer. For patients with EGRF mutation, alotrinib is the very effective treatment.
Yeah.
So.
Just a comment that the committee will probably take up in closed session, but it seemed to me that your aims were a little bit vague and exactly when you'd be done. At what point does this thing become a PhD thesis rather than a 30-year research plan? You know, what's the end point for your thesis?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, I think aggressively it could be finished in a year. And I mean, obviously there's some.
What do you have to achieve to do that?
What?
What do you have to achieve to say, now I'm done?
Well, I mean, I think I overviewed some of the goals that I wanted to attempt.
Yeah, but they were all kind of, well, we have this, and it wasn't, the aims were all kind of open-ended.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering where you're going to say, okay, that's where the PhD ends and the postdoc starts.
Sure. yeah, that's a good question. I mean, when I think that's a decision, obviously, I have to make on each aim as it goes along. You know, for some of them, like the first aim is going to be a lot easier because I can just attach the data and then we can say, okay, that's done. We'll just continue to run that as it goes along. The third aim, obviously, is way open-ended because it's not even very well defined based on the beginning results, and depending on how that pans out, it may turn into something larger. You know, the middle aim, obviously, it just depends on when unfortunately, that sequencing data is a little bit at the whim of when the sequencing data is actually produced and our ability. I mean, we can start to work with it now, and
yeah.
Again, that's a, you know, just as far as getting that model built, for example, for the second aim, if we can actually model gene fusion and model the allele specific and isoform specific stuff, you know, that's great. Then that's done. I think. I mean, the third one is really the open-ended analysis one, that's more analysis based versus. I think the first two have some sort of real programmatic goals that I can say, okay, the program does this now, done. And then it's just a matter of when I decide that we've run it on enough data to say, okay, this is my thesis. So.
We have the sequencing data now that
we can start to work with.
Yeah, starting for sure.
Can I ask one more question? Mm-hmm. I think it was like 10 years ago that Lee Hood said that this classification of cancers by tissue of origin is erroneous, that the underlying, you know, pathway signatures are classified irrespective of their tissue of origin. But yet we seem to be still focused on breast, ovarian,
yeah.
Lung. Are you seeing pathway signatures that are more common among different tissues than they are, you know,
yes.
Segregated by tissue?
Yeah, I think Sophie pointed that out great with the HIF-1 alpha example. I mean, that was
yeah.
a great example where, you know, as you can see here, it's actually kind of reversed. In ovarian, you know, we have a subset or that subset that have high HIF-1 alpha versus in glioblastoma, we have a subset that are low HIF-1 alpha. But those actually map out to the same ultimate response, survival and maybe response to treatment. That these patients have received. And I'm sure as I continue this analysis, some of the same patterns will occur. FOXM1, for instance, had never been implicated in ovarian cancer before, but we do see that in some of the glioblastoma where it has been seen as an active, overactive pathway.
Pancreatic as well.
So it seems like
but
we
I think
have
that's
more
a
data.
Major hypothesis we're testing with TCGA, right? We're going to be doing 20 cancers
yeah.
and. We will know
right.
at the end of 3 years.
It's just when people go to collect the data, they want, you know, a concise
yeah.
story on the one type of cancer.
And it's easier clinically to get yeah, that tissue.
Absolutely.
The same.
And of course, though, there is an influence. The tissue
right.
type has specified a lot of epigenetics and gene activities
yeah.
that form a milieu, a background, a setting for the cancer to evolve. And that setting is different for different tissues. So
right.
It's going to be very, the tissue type is going to be very influential.
Yeah.
You can't
So he wasn't exactly right. I mean, that's...
Well, it's an extreme position to say, forget right. the tissue of origin.
Yeah, if you look at the Coffinova profiles, the gynecological cancers, they're remarkably similar, whether it's ovarian, breast, so they're responding, they're probably responding to the same kind of environments. Any more questions from the public before we close this off and start the drilling?